the year 1959, my dear friends, may come to be known as the year of the great thaw, or the year of the great peace pilgrimages. And two names will be associated with these events, Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Mr. Khrushchev's visit to the United States during the past year was a sensational, ice-breaking event in the deadly frozen relations between the East and the West. And Mr. Eisenhower's visit to 11 countries on three continents was an unprecedented visit of an Argonaut in quest of the golden fleece of peace ever recorded, in my judgment, in the political annals of nations. Now, these visits would not have taken place, would not have been possible, if the leading statesmen of the world had not finally been pressured by conditions at home and by the menacing situation into which they had maneuvered themselves in their Cold War strategy, in their Cold War plottings and counterplottings, in a nuclear age since the Second World War. The prospects of this Cold War have finally begun to frighten the statesmen of the world, even as they had begun to frighten the peoples of the world. And the sobering realization that in a modern atomic war, neither side could possibly win, and both sides most assuredly would lose totally and completely. And finally, and so the statesmen of the world under these pressures had decided, without of course announcing in so many words the fact, they decided to abandon the Cold War and to try to work out ways of peaceful coexistence. Now, Mr. Khrushchev did not come to the United States to get himself photographed, and President Eisenhower did not travel a strenuous schedule of 22,000 miles to hear himself cheered. They were traveling at the behest of a much more serious and pressing mission, upon whose ultimate outcome the very future of our world might well depend. They were out to discover what were the real prospects for peace or war. Is it to be a war of extermination tomorrow, in 5 years, in 10 years? Or is it to be international cooperation in peace. They wanted to feel the pulse of peoples and of governments. They wanted to appraise moods, to sense the political climate of the world. And both men, by their own testimony, came away from their visits convinced that everywhere peoples wanted peace, and that there did not in fact exist those insurmountable walls, those impenetrable walls, those terrible obstacles of hate and fear and prejudice which had been so loudly and interminably proclaimed ever since the Second World War and before. President Eisenhower has not yet returned Khrushchev's visit, and he is yet to visit the Soviet Union, but he already gave his answer, even as he found his answer, during his extensive tour for which he has recently returned. He spoke as the champion not of a divided world, but of one world. He was the spokesman of world peace and of world reconciliation, and was so welcomed by the millions who acclaimed him everywhere on his visit. Now, in the past, other Americans, noted Americans, notably the former Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles. In the past, other Americans had visited countries abroad, some of the very countries which President Eisenhower visited. But their reception was markedly different. Well, President Eisenhower's visit was not undertaken, as he himself put it the other day, as a feature of normal diplomatic procedures. It was not his purpose, he said, to seek specific agreements or to urge new treaty relationships. The others who had come to these non-committed countries of the world, not only from the United States, but from other countries as well. The others came either openly or by implication to forge alliances of one kind or another, to build strength against another nation or another bloc of nations, against a potential foe. But here was a man who was not trying to organize one part of the world against the other, but to improve, as he said, the political climate of the world so that a new kind of diplomacy with world peace and justice as its objectives, that a new kind of diplomacy might have a chance to work, successfully to work, for the good of all. Here was the head of the most powerful government of the world and the spokesman of its oldest democracy declaring, in the hearing of everybody, our concept of the good life for humanity does not require an inevitable conflict between peoples and systems in which one must triumph over the other. This was the President of the United States speaking these words. Which in my mind mark a sharp turnabout in our Cold War diplomacy. And the heart of the world heard this and was glad. Now, if these sincere convictions and utterances of President Eisenhower are followed through, and those that Mr. Khrushchev uttered in his historic address before the United Nations, then a new day may really begin for mankind. If they are followed through in practice, and if they become the guide in all future negotiations, then the forthcoming summit conference or conferences may really open a new and promising era for world peace and progress. And 1959 will really be the year of the great thaw. And perhaps something will then be done about world disarmament, the curse of the 20th century. At the last meeting of the United Nations, all the nations of the world, following Mr. Khrushchev's address, voted unanimously for disarmament and vied with one another in stressing its desperate urgency. But this, my dear friends, has been a solemn but meaningless ritual with statesmen for a long, long time now. A lip service to a venerable ideal without any specific commitments. Something holy, something which can be deferred unto the end of days. But times have now changed, sharply changed, radically changed. Disarmament today is tied up inseparably with survival of nations. President Eisenhower pleaded the other day for increased help to the underprivileged peoples of the earth who need it in their struggle against poverty, misery, and disease. Denied it, he said, and these peoples could well become so desperate as to create a world catastrophe. But we cannot increase our foreign aid indefinitely and at the same time increase our expenditures for armaments indefinitely without going bankrupt. And that is true of the Soviet Union as well. We cannot maintain our standard of living and at the same time contributes substantially to the betterment and progress of the underdeveloped part of the world community without curbing the voracious appetite of our war machine, which is today consuming more than half of our entire national budget. This is true also of the Soviet Union, where military expenditures are definitely defeating any substantial improvement in the standard of living of the people. Now, the real test, my dear friends, of the practical success of President Eisenhower's visits and that of Mr. Khrushchev The real test will soon come. In fact, it is even now being prepared in the various chancelleries of the world, in our own State Department as well. It may yet be that the little foxes will again spoil the vineyard of humanity's hopes. The foxes, they're not so little at that. The foxes, working unobserved in all the key places of the world, day after day. The reactionaries everywhere, the ideological fanatics, the professional militarists, the nationalistic romantics, and all those who preach peace on earth, but not peace for the communists. And it is our relation with the communists which alone will determine whether there will be peace on earth or war. These little foxes may still spoil the vineyard, as they have done time and again in the past. We hope that the larger vision will finally come to prevail, and that the next decade will see real progress in disarmament, in international cooperation, and in dissolving many of the issues which have divided, and sadly divided, and dangerously divided our world in the last two decades. The year 1959, dear friends, also uncovered much that was morally unsavory in our American life. Radio and television scandals, payola, rigged quizzes, bribes and kickbacks, fake systems of rating, a veritable network of dishonesty, fraud, and deceit, which touched and smeared and stained and besmirched artist and producer and sponsor and the whole industry alike. And all this came on top of what has been a steady mounting of violence and vulgarity and gun-toting in the plays and gutter melodramas which this mass media entertainment form has been channeling into the millions of American homes. I spoke of that, some of you may recall, more fully a few weeks ago. All of this, of course, was due to the lure of easy money, to getting something for nothing, to reaching out to what's called the fast buck. Later in the year came startling revelations of the dangerous use of chemicals in food productions. And some of them possessed of cancer-inducing properties. Cranberries and chickens and cattle and seed grain, and also candies and lipsticks. And the purpose of all these additives, in most instances, was to increase profits, to spur the growth of chickens, to fatten the cattle and sheep, to increase profits and to color foods and cosmetics, to make them more attractive, and so to increase sales and profits. And then came the revelations of the fantastic markups in the price of certain drugs and pharmaceutical products. Amazing markups. And again, the American people witnessed, read the disreputable story of prophets without conscience. Now, all these, I believe, are danger signals, not to be ignored. They underscore the fact that all is not well with the moral health of our nation. All this would not have happened if our moral standards had not sagged, seriously sagged. And corruption in one or another part of the body politic has a way, like cancer, of spreading, and if not checked, will destroy the whole fabric of vital, the whole fabric of the life, the vitality of a people. There has been sharp warning in what happened in the year 1959, which the American people cannot afford to disregard. A stock taking is in order, and a house cleaning. Nor can the American people disregard the lessons of the long drawn out steel strike of 1959. A strike which may be resumed after the Taft-Hartley cooling off period is ended, and the vote which will be taken among the steel workers on the company's last offer will be taken and in all likelihood rejected by the steel workers. Of this steel strike, I also spoke a few weeks ago in greater detail. I can only repeat my conviction that in this strike, neither management nor labor evidenced any high degree of industrial statesmanship, any far-sighted flexibility. Their insistence on unconditional surrender showed little regard for the interest of the American public, and they hurt the cause of collective bargaining and may, unless avoided in time, and the time is becoming very short, and may force government to intervene in a way neither side would relish. I said then, and I repeat, that the only face-saving avenue which is now open to management and labor is voluntarily to refer the issue to an arbitration group of public-spirited citizens who should be asked to render a decision. I understand that labor was willing to go along with such a suggestion, and industry expressed its unwillingness. Among religious editors who were polled, the controversy over birth control was the biggest news of the year. And this issue was precipitated by a pronouncement last November of over 200 bishops of the Catholic Church. They expressed the conviction that artificial birth control was morally unacceptable under the natural law of God. They expressed opposition to the use of public funds to promote artificial birth control at home or abroad. They were especially opposed to the use of our foreign aid for the encouragement of birth control into the underdeveloped countries, among the underdeveloped peoples, whose vastly increasing populations are defeating all efforts at raising their standard of living and reducing poverty, misery, and disease. Some of you may recall that upon my return from a visit to India and the Far East, I pointed to this fact, this explosion of population in those lands, as their most pressing and urgent problem. Sharp rejoinders soon came from leaders of the Protestant churches and from others. And the whole question was soon given a political bias, a political angle, because the question was soon raised, would this policy, as laid down by the Catholic hierarchy, be binding upon Roman Catholic candidates for office? Now, this controversy will continue for many, many years into the future. And I am persuaded that in the long run, and in the last analysis, it will be life and not dogma which will decide this issue. The position of liberal Judaism and of conservative Judaism on this subject was previously stated in resolutions which were adopted quite a few years ago. And the Union of American Hebrew Congregation, at its last meeting in November of this year, adopted the following resolution on the subject of birth control. Judaism is dedicated to the sanctity of human life. Jewish tradition emphasizes the importance of spiritual and material well-being in secure family groups. Therefore, we are concerned with restrictions placed upon the availability of information and medical assistance in the planning of families. We fully recognize the right of all persons, for religious reasons or otherwise, to abstain from or to practice birth control as they see fit. However, the failure of large sections of our population to plan their families effectively is due neither to conscience nor to free choice, but rather to legal and official obstacles imposed upon many Americans, with the result depriving them of knowledge and medical assistance in this field. This dearth of information and assistance most directly affects those families which, for lack of financial and educational resources, have the greatest need. Many social problems, including desertion, non-support of families, illegitimacy, high divorce rates, mental and emotional instability, may be the result in part of ineffectual birth control practices in our society. When government responds to the theological beliefs of any religious group by interfering with the dissemination of birth control information to all who desire it, such interference represents an improper imposition of such religious beliefs upon the community at large. Therefore, be it resolved that we favor the elimination of all restrictions and prohibitions against the dissemination of birth control information and the rendering of birth control assistance by qualified physicians and clinics and hospitals. We favor the wider dissemination of birth control information and medical assistance, both by private groups such as the Planned Parenthood Association and health agencies of local, state, and the federal government, as a vital service to be rendered in the field of public health. This is the resolution adopted by all the Reformed congregations of the United States. I am persuaded that the position here taken is a sound position. And I believe, too, that such information and such medical assistance should not be withheld from governments and peoples who may request it in their effort to solve the problem of ruinous overpopulation. I do not believe that the granting of foreign aid on our part should be made conditional upon the recipient countries either adopting or refusing to adopt birth control measures. But if requested by them, we should certainly give our aid, whatever assistance we can. Birth control is not the sole solution of the grave economic problems presented by increased populations. But without it, all other solutions will simply fail of their mark because they will be washed out by the flood tide of an ever-increasing and all-inundating population. It would be a great pity to see this issue dragged into the political arena where it does not belong. In the immediate year, good friends, which lie ahead, there will be more people in the world, and they will create vast new problems. There will be more old people in the world for the health in certain countries will be greatly improved, and there will be presented to us vast social problems of caring for the aged and of making the golden years of their lives more purposeful and happier. In the years to come, in the immediate years to come, there will be a more determined thrust forward on the part of all the backward and underprivileged peoples of the earth, all over the globe, to obtain more of what their people need, what they believe their people are entitled to, and to possess that in sovereignty and in freedom. Large areas of the earth, in Asia and Africa and in Latin America, will undergo great political changes. Communist world and the so-called capitalist world will also experience the pull and tension of severe inner readjustments. We're not facing a world without problems. Outer space will beckon the scientist everywhere. And mankind will delve ever deeper into the sources of power and energy and will seek new ways of doing all things better. Given peace, all these adjustments can be made and all these good and hopeful things can come to pass. Not always easily, but surely. A man's mind is amazingly resourceful. And human life is capable of amazing adaptability and resilience. All these things are possible with peace. Without peace, global peace, there is only the prospect of chaos and darkness and death. Will the world choose life in the immediate years to come? I've always had confidence in man and faith in God. And I believe that mankind is moving into a brighter and more promising day. The challenge to us is to be on the alert, not to permit the one thing which may destroy that promise for us and our children, and for generations yet unborn, not to permit the little foxes to destroy the vineyard of humanity's hopes.